Good morning, Shabbat Shalom, and welcome to United Israel World Union. This is our Sabbath morning scripture study coming to you live from St. Francisville, Louisiana. Thank you so much for joining us today. We are presently in class six of our ongoing study, our new series that began 6 weeks ago. And the series is called The Pentateuch, A New Look. We are working through the five books of the Pentateuch, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, according to the annual cycle of readings. Give or take a little bit, we sometimes pull from the ending of one or the beginning of the next, because sometimes these divisions don't quite follow an underlying structure that I've been showing over the last few weeks. Now, this class today, is the third of three in what I guess you could call a mini-series within the series. So we've been talking about the life of Abraham, and this life of Abraham material is contained within one of these underlying structural pieces that I'm referring to over the last few weeks. And that is that throughout the book of Genesis, and it only takes place in Genesis, we have a series of 10, call them chapters or ancient stories, which themselves are composed of other ancient stories. And the one that deals with the life of Abraham is called Ele Toledot Terach. Now, we know that Terach is the one through whom Abraham comes into being. So there are 10 of these, Ele Toledot, in the book of Genesis. This one covers the life of Abraham, Ele Toledot Terach. Now, as far as the Pentateuch reading that we're following loosely today, we're in Chaye Sarah. And this is really about, at least in part, Sarah. Now, this particular reading from the Pentateuch on the annual cycle of readings begins in chapter 23, verse 1, and runs through chapter 25 and verse 18, and that's Chaye Sarah. Now, Ele Toledot Terach, this ancient composition that the compiler or the redactor put together for us, which contains other ancient stories, really begins the life of Abraham prior to, it actually begins in chapter 11 and verse 27, at the end of what we call Torah portion Noach. So you can see the divisions, the lines aren't quite precise, they don't quite follow these ancient Pentateuchal readings. So Ele Toledot Terach, which contains the life of Abraham, begins at the end of portion Noah in 11:27 and runs all the way, but it ends right before the conclusion of Chaye Sarah. It actually ends in chapter 25, verse 11, and we're going to talk a little bit about that as we go. Now, within this group of things that we're going to cover today, within the main stories that we're going to talk about today as we take a new look at the Pentateuchal sources, what we're going to be reading about are several main stories within the story. One is the death of Sarah. It begins in chapter 23 with the death of Sarah just by mention, and then the bulk of chapter 23 deals with Abraham making a deal, a land deal, okay? He's securing a burial plot within the land of Canaan from the people of the land of Canaan to put away, as it says in the Hebrew, the dead, my dead, from my sight. So he wants to secure a plot of land, and we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about that in the ancient culture. What's going on in there? Who is this? Who are the Hittites? And who is he dealing with here? And so forth. Then we have in chapter 24 this absolutely beautiful, let's call it a love story. All right? It doesn't seem like it's going to be a love story in some ways, but it turns out that it is a love story where Abraham is sending his servant, by the way, his unnamed servant. A lot of sources will tell us that that servant's name is Eliezer, but the Bible doesn't tell us it's Eliezer. We only know that it's a servant. So a lot of people make that jump and say, oh, it's Eliezer, but the text doesn't say that. But anyway, one of the things that's so nice about this particular story is it reveals that the writer wants us to see beyond the story itself, beyond the journey of the servant and beyond the people that he meets. The writer wants us to see that behind that, that beyond that is this beautiful guiding hand, providentially making the arrangement to put the right person in the right place at the right time, and turns out it all, as they say in so many stories, they lived happily ever after. So it's one of those beautiful stories in the Bible. It's the longest chapter in the Bible, in Genesis, among the stories that we read. So the writer really wants us to focus on that, and we will. This particular Pentateuch section, this Parsha, also covers, after the death of Sarah, that Abraham gets another woman. Now, the question is it another woman, or have some of the commentators seen something that we may have missed? I mean, this is not something I'm going to solve for you necessarily, but some propose, such as Jewish rabbinic writings, for instance, Genesis Rabbah will tell us that Keturah is just another name for Hagar. And we had to wonder, is that true? I kind of have to leave some stuff for you. You have to figure out what you think there, because the writer doesn't tell us, all right? So are they right when they make that suggestion or not? We'll talk about it. And then in this particular Parsha, we read about Abraham's death. So we start with the death or the announcement that Sarah has died. By the time we get to the end of Chaye Sarah, we read that Abraham, too, dies. And that is placed appropriately, I might add, at the closing of Ele Toledot Terach. So we begin in 1127 of Genesis, Ele Toledot Terach, where we read about the birth of Abraham. And then at the end of Ele Toledot Terach, as you would expect an ancient writer to close the narrative, with the death of Abraham. We're going to talk about that. But I think that that in and of itself shows that there is a brilliant organization that the final assembler, the compiler, the redactor used of these ancient sources. Now, for the present, you're allowed to put whoever you want in the spot of that final redactor. If you believe through tradition that that final redactor or compiler is Moses himself, that's fine. What we want to stress, though, is that these ancient stories clearly took place at a time prior to the assembly of them in the form in which we get them, right? I mean, that's obvious. We have to admit that. Whether a person sees a divine order, a divine inspiration, a divine redaction, that's okay. But understand that whoever is writing this was not there when the world was created. They were not there when Adam and Chava were in the Garden of Eden. They were not there when Noah's Ark, you see what I'm saying. So there, at some point in history, someone or someones, if you want to make that plural, assembled ancient stories. Now, how did they get these stories? Were they passed down? One of the things that I'd like to show as I work through this material, not only this week, but in the weeks to follow, is that there is clearly an order, but there is also the idea that we're dealing with separate sources. So, for instance, if I have two scrolls here, and I'm going to represent these are two scrolls, two ancient stories that come to the final redactor. And this is story A, okay? And this story is here, and the redactor also has story B. Now, there is sometimes where the material overlaps for reasons known to the final editor, the final compiler. So you might have stories in scroll B which predate stories in scroll A. So there's some overlap. Does that make sense? So you're going to see examples of that. Doesn't discredit either story. That's not my point here. But what we want to do is we want to identify where those stories overlap and where they butt up nicely together. So I'm showing you some of the seams, if you will, S-E-A-M-S, of these ancient stories as they've come to us. And that's what's going to be fun about this. But in other words, as this assembler or the assemblers pull these stories together, we're going to see some really interesting things about how things come together in these ancient storytellings. Now, at the end of Ele Toledot Tirach, as I said, we have mention of Abraham's death. All right? Now, there's only one thing in Ele Toledot Tirach that follows the death of Abraham. And I think it's wonderful. I think it indicates what a great assembler this is that puts it together. Look with me at Genesis 25, verse 11. 25, verse 11. I'm jumping ahead just for a moment to set some boundaries for our class today. And it says in 25:11, after the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac, his son, and Isaac settled at Be'er Lachai Roi. Interesting. So what the person who pulled together the material known as Ele Toledot Tirach wants us to do is be ready, be focused in these sacred histories, and the person wants us to look next to who? Isaac. So everything we've been studying has other characters, but it's dealing with Abraham. And then the last thing it says, and Abraham died, and oh, by the way, after the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac, his son, and Isaac settled at Be'er Lachai Roi. Now, this particular parsha, remember the annual cycle of readings that comes out of Babylon, these are ancient readings. But the person or people who put this cycle of readings together didn't necessarily follow these to a T, these ancient Ele Toledot sections. And there's a reason for that. I'm not being critical, because some of these are very, very short. In fact, this particular portion, or Parsha, Chaye Sarah, after the conclusion of Ele Toledot Tirach, includes an entire other one because it's only seven verses long. In this particular section, chapter 25 of Genesis, verses 12 through 18, 25, 12 through 18, is an entire other Ele Toledot, but this one is Ele Toledot Ishmael. And in that particular section, we get a brief overview of Ishmael. Remember, Ishmael, obviously, is the son of Abraham through Hagar. We read in this particular section of his descendants, and we also read that he died as well. So, technically, and this is something you need to understand, by the close of Chaye Sarah, the material that we're covering today, we have Sarah, Abraham, and Ishmael are all dead. So we're going through a major part in the patriarchal narratives here, and they're dying and they're dead by the time this is over. Sarah, Abraham, and Ishmael. So today, I want to focus on these to get us ready, because beginning next week, our focus, as you saw at the close of Eileh Toledot Tarak, our focus becomes Isaac and Rebekah. So we have to get ready for that. So that's what we're going to do for the most part today. Now, the announcement of Sarah's death comes immediately after the conclusion of what is known as the Akedah, the binding of Isaac. The binding of Isaac is the story in chapter 22 of the book of Genesis, where Abraham is told to take his son, his only son, the one that you love, go to the place that I'll show you, and there you're going to offer him as an olah, burnt offering. And you know the story. We covered that in last week's class. Sarah's death is reported on the heels of that story. And what that led some commentators to do is connect the two. So what some commentators have done, and you can understand how they could get to that, is they said, they comment, this is their view, that when Sarah hears that this event has taken place, she just dies. Now, the text doesn't tell us when Sarah heard the news that she died. The text just reports the event at of the Akedah, and then Sarah, it says, died. Now, you read one right behind the other, you can make that connection. I'm not suggesting that those two are connected, but it's tempting to at least make that association. The author, the compiler, the editor, the redactor leaves it to you. Here's what we can tell you. Here are the facts of the story. You make those decisions. And I think it's okay to make some of those decisions. I think we just have to be careful and differentiate between what we think, what we suppose, our comments, and what the text actually says. That's just the only cautionary point I would give. But imagine the strain on a family if this story were told. Now, we tend to think, we make excuses a lot of times. We look at a text and we say, well, you know, at that time, there was human sacrifice, at that time this, at that time that. But this is shocking. I think it was shocking in the ancient world. I think it's shocking today. And I don't think we should dismiss the shock factor. Here's a man. Imagine how the story goes. He says, God told me to sacrifice my son in a burnt offering. Now imagine if you're Sarah. You did what? I don't think we should dismiss that shock. You see what I'm saying? Now, the story, as it is presented to us, I want to stress this, that earlier in the life of Abraham, we read of the importance of family. We read of the importance of the family. That such an event, I think it ties to this. I want you to go with me this morning to Genesis chapter 18. Genesis chapter 18, verse 17. The Lord said, or Jehovah said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I've chosen him that he may command his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring to Abraham what he has promised him. So what we see towards the beginning of this one great year of Abraham's life, Genesis chapter 18, we talked about that last week as well, is that there is a focus on the familial aspects of Abrahamic faith, right? It begins in the family. The reason that God chooses Abraham, according to Genesis 18, 17 through 19, is that he knows that Abraham is going to command his children and his household beyond his family, those who are a part of his household, to keep the way of Jehovah, to do justice and righteousness. Now, interestingly enough, and I want you to think about this, we aren't really provided with indications, with any indications that are very, very strongly communicating this point in the stories of Abraham's life. In other words, that demonstrate such a passing on of the faith. Now, I know you're thinking, well, what about this? What about that? You know, there are passages which talk about Abraham and his faithfulness and so forth. But in terms of Abraham's family, we don't really get a lot of that. Now, that doesn't mean it didn't happen. Remember, we have 175 years of Abraham's life, and of that 175 years, most of what we get in the life of Abraham is focused on 100 years of that. And then of the 14 chapters that deal with the 175 years of Abraham's life, give or take, we have five chapters of the 14, which focus on a single year. So of the 175 years, there are a lot of things that obviously happened in the life of Abraham that we don't have recorded in the histories, our sacred histories. What does come across very, very clearly is in the stories of Abraham is his very strong faith, okay? That comes across very clearly. We get the idea that Abraham, remember in Genesis 12, he gets the call to leave everything with which he's familiar. He's to leave his place of birth, his father's house, and so forth, and go to a place that God's going to show him. In other words, he leaves everything that's familiar based on a call to go to an unknown, unseen land. And then in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 6, he gets this promise in the covenant of the pieces, as it's called, where he looks up, he's shown the stars of the night, and he's told, count the stars if you can, so shall your seed be. So Abraham has faith. He says he trusted in the words of Jehovah, Genesis 15, 6, and God accounts that to him for righteousness. Again, it's because he trusts, he believes, he obeys. We get this throughout the text. We get this underlying. That's what we get in terms of Abraham's faithfulness and possible reasons that he's chosen. Remember, one of the things that I like to point out as often as I can is that it's not, according to the text, his chosenness is not out of Ur of the Chaldees or Haran, as the case might be. It's not that his righteousness is established there and then God calls him out to use him, but he calls him out to use him and brings him to that place in faith. All right, there's a difference. As far as we know, Joshua 24 says that the family was in idolatry in the land across the river, and then he comes over and so forth. Now, what we do have is two times in the Hebrew Bible, we have two passages that call Abraham, in English, generally, the friend of God. Go to Isaiah 41, Isaiah 41, 8. But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, the offspring of Abraham, my friend. And then the other one, just for your notes, is 2 Chronicles chapter 20, and verse 7. Did you not, our God, 2 Chronicles 20 and verse 7, drive out the inhabitants of this land before your people Israel and give it forever to the descendants of Abraham, your friend? Now, the word friend there, as I've pointed out in numerous classes, is really the root word is ahav, which means to love. So I think maybe a better translation is the beloved. So Abraham is the one person that's called the beloved of God. And then another thing that stands out is that most, when we talk about Abraham and the reason he's in such a place with God, the other thing that stands out is that most of what Abraham is promised is fulfilled or comes to its fullness only long after Abraham is dead. Again, an indication that he is a faithful person, that he trusts that these things will come even prior to their coming. Perhaps this is one of the reasons that Abraham becomes known by much of the world as the father of the faithful, okay? He's known in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam as this faithful father figure. You know, he's got father in his name, a father of a multitudes, basically. Multitudes descend from Abraham. We all probably grew up with the song, Father Abraham has many sons. Many sons has Father Abraham, and I am one of them. Well, that may or may not be the case, but the idea is that Abraham did indeed have many sons, and this is part of the promise that is visible now that wasn't necessarily visible in the ancient times. Now, in his own life, he saw the beginnings of the fulfillment of the promises. Remember, he has promises from God for property and progeny, land and descendants. And for much of his life, he goes without the promise of either. But he continues to trust. Now, the fulfillment of these promises, he only sees the beginning in his lifetime, though he has Ishmael through Hagar and several other sons through Keturah, as we'll read at the end in chapter 25. Like Ishmael, these other boys that are mentioned in chapter 25 are sent away. They're sent away to the east. Now, you might be saying, yeah, but it's through Isaac that your seed will be called. Okay, but hang on. The promises of many also fall to Ishmael. He too will be great. He too will become a leader and have so many princes, 12 princes, and so forth. But one of the things that I think about when I think about this particular parsha is one wonders how much direction or commanding was received from Abraham to his descendants. Remember Genesis 18, 17 through 19. He will command his sons after him. Now, you could say it happened. There must have been, and I'm not denying that. I'm just suggesting to you that we don't get a lot of that in the text itself. We know God said he chose him because he's going to command his sons after him to do the way of Jehovah, which is ultimately to do what is just and right in the earth. The Bible wants us to direct us to Isaac. In Genesis chapter 21 and verse 12, look there with me, Genesis 21, 12. The focus is here. But God said to Abraham, be not displeased because of the boy and because of your slave woman. Whatever Sarah says to you, do as she tells you, for though it's through Isaac that your seed shall be named. So it's through Isaac that we're going to be focused on this passing down through the family. But again, one has to wonder the effect of the Akedah on that. Think about this. After the binding of Isaac, did this create any strain? Now, based on the narrative, Isaac is not a little boy. You know, some of the, I think, Sunday school literature or things that you might see, coloring books, might show Isaac as a little bitty boy, but he's not. He's a grown man. He's in his 30s, based on the chronology of the text, at least. He's likely in his 30s. If you follow, by the time you get to chapter 23, when Sarah's death, we learn that Sarah is 127 when she dies. She was 90 when she had Isaac, so that would make him 37 at the time of Sarah's death. Now, we don't know exactly how soon after the binding of Isaac that Sarah died. We just know that it comes in the text immediately after that story. So, is he 37? Is he 30? You know, how many years have gone by between the binding of Isaac and the death of Sarah? It could be that it's very soon after. We just can't say for sure. Now, a couple other things while we're focused on this. I want you to look at the close of chapter 21, Genesis 21, verse 31. It says, therefore, that place was called Beersheba, because there both of them swore an oath. So they made a covenant at Beersheba. Avimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, rose up and returned to the land of the Philistines. Abraham planted a tamarisk tree in Beersheba and called there on the name of Jehovah, the everlasting God. And then Abraham sojourned many days. The idea we're left with is that in chapter 21, Abraham is in Beersheba. Then we have the story of the Akedah. I'm just trying to place, is the family together or apart? Now, we know that the boys, Ishmael and Hagar, are sent away. So, at best, we have Abraham and Sarah and Isaac living together. But here at the end of chapter 21, it seems that Abraham is at Beersheba. At the end of the story of the Akedah, we get Abraham goes to Beersheba, and there's no mention of Isaac, right? At the end of the story, it says, look at chapter 22, Genesis 22. And let me give you the exact verse here. Verse 19, 22, 19. So Abraham returned to his young men. Notice, no mention of Isaac. And they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. All right, so where's Abraham? He's back, I believe, where he was prior to this incident. Now, when we read of Sarah's death, it's in Hebron. Now, if you're not looking at a map, those aren't right next to each other. Now, what's the reason for that? I'm not speculating here. I'm just giving you the data points. We do have the mention that she's at Hebron. Now, Hebron is about 25 to 30 miles from Beersheba. All right? Hebron is 25 to 30 miles north of Beersheba. And that's where Sarah is, and that's where Sarah dies. Now, I also want you to notice for a data point that the end of chapter 24, we learn that it's been 3 years since Sarah died when the story goes forward with meeting the woman for Isaac, okay? And I just have this in my notes, so let me look at this, Genesis 24. And verse 62, let's see if that's right. Notice it says, now Isaac had returned from Be'er Lachai Roi and was dwelling in the Negev. So I want to create this. I want you to think about this. Pull out a map, make notes of this. A lot of people miss some of these ideas, but I want you to think about this as we look at the text deeply. We have Abraham is at Beersheba. We have Sarah is at Hebron. Now, some of you are probably saying, well, he may have moved to Hebron. Hold that thought. And then Isaac is at Be'er Lachai Roi, which is in a different place. So they're all living in different places in this section of text we're dealing with. Now, we know this place called Be'er Lachai Roi. How do we know that? It's mentioned elsewhere. We know it because it is a well. Be'er is well in Hebrew. It's a well from the story of Hagar, where another son of Abraham nearly died. Abram at the time. Look with me at Genesis 16. This, by the way, I'm bringing this up because this is where Isaac is. Genesis 16 and verse 7. The angel of Jehovah found her by a spring of water, talking about Hagar, in the wilderness, the spring on the way to Shur. This is in the west. And he said, Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going? And she said, I'm fleeing from my mistress Sarai. The angel of Jehovah said to her, return to your mistress and submit to her. The angel of Jehovah also said to her, I will surely multiply your seed so that they cannot be numbered for multitude. And the angel of Jehovah said to her, behold, you are pregnant, shall bear a son. You'll call his name Ishmael because Jehovah has listened to your affliction. He shall be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone and everyone's hand against him. And he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen. So she called the name of Jehovah who spoke to her, you are a God of seeing. For she said, truly, here I've seen him who looks after me. Therefore, the well was called Be'er Lachai Roi. It lies between Kadesh and Bered. So, this location is known to us from the patriarchal narratives. It's not, people can debate exactly where it's at, but it's not Beersheba. It's not Hebron. This is where Isaac is. All right? And after Abraham dies, Isaac returns there and dwells there. Just to kind of put this together, look at Genesis chapter 25 and verse 11. Genesis 25, 11. After the death of Abraham, God blessed Isaac, his son, and Isaac settled at Be'er Lachai Roi. Now, this is interesting to me because a lot of times we separate Isaac and Ishmael. And yet, this place that's so central to the Ishmael story is where Isaac finds it most suitable to live. And again, there is the connection between the two boys, the near-death experiences of both of Abraham's sons. That is very strange. Both of these sons. Our stories don't hide that the sons of Abraham lived apart from each other, and apart from Abraham, who is, we have to remember, Genesis 18, it's about this family, and yet the family appears at times to be fragmented. Some of you have family that's fragmented too. Well, maybe this will be comforting to you, because even Abraham, whose main mission is part of being a family that is quite troubled. There's trouble in this family. Now, for those of you who think that Abraham and Sarah both live at Hebron at this time, remember I showed you that Abraham's at Beersheba, but look at chapter 23. This is where the Parsha begins. Genesis 23, verse 1 and 2. It says this, Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. Sarah died at Kiriat Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abraham went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. Now, you might read an English translation that indicates to you that Abraham is outside the door and she dies and he goes in. But it literally says, Vayavo Avraham. Abraham goes to another place to mourn and bewail Sarah. So she's died. Word gets to him. He goes to Hebron. He's not at Hebron. There's another way to say he went in to mourn her from outside the tent. He's coming into town, basically. Now, the rest of chapter 23 in Genesis provides a story of Abraham acquiring a burial plot, a burial place for Sarah, chapter 23, verses 1 through 20. And he's purchasing this from the Hittites, okay? The question becomes, who are the Hittites? Now, in particular, he buys from one named Ephron, the Hittite, for 400 shekels. Now, there are many studies of everything in academia. You can find studies on any given subject, and they're fun to look through these. You know, there are quite a few sites you can find these on. But what I got curious about was 400 shekels is a lot of money. And so there are quite a few academic studies on this, and I just wanted to share a couple of bullet points of what I found this week. First of all, it is a high price, and we do get another land deal, Jeremiah 32, 9. In Jeremiah 32, 9, you can go there, but I'll just tell you. Jeremiah purchases, or there's a transaction involving Jeremiah for a piece of land, and it sells for 17 shekels, and that's in the 7th century BCE. Now, admittedly, times were tough. Real estate's rock bottom. Why? Because it's in the middle of a siege. In fact, that's the main point. You buy low, you sell high in real estate, right? I'm not a real estate agent, but anybody knows that. So this purchase is meant to say, it's not over. God's not through with us. You know, this deed and so forth. Jeremiah 32, 9, 17 shekels. Now, we do have from antiquity 6 real estate contracts that date to the 13th to the 12th century BCE. Now, these are from Ugaritic text, which is similar to Hebrew and Phoenician. It's from the same family of languages, but it's written in cuneiform. And you can Google these and look up cuneiform or Ugaritic. Now, there are 6 real estate deals from the time period. Now, this is later than Abraham's time. But of the 6 in these particular texts that I'm referring to, there was an article in the Journal of American Oriental Society in 1979 by Robert Steiglitz. And he shows that 3 of the 6 land deals go for 400 shekels. So it's common at a later time. But my point is that it's much later. So this is an enormous amount of money. You know, you remember the debate, the back and forth. Abraham says, you know, I need a place to bury my dead. And what's 400 shekels between us? You know, just take it. But Abraham wants to pay for it. He wants to make sure that no one comes back and says, you know, this is not yours. So he wants it all on the up and up. The question becomes, who are the Hittites? Who are these Hittites? Now, when we read in the Bible about the Hittites, or when we read historical sources, there are a couple of different groups that are known as the Hittites. Some argue that they're the same, or that they're one comes from the other, but just bear with me as I work through this. It's such an important part of the story, because this is where the land actually is purchased from. So one group, known as the Hittites from antiquity, is from Anatolia in Turkey. All right, now, I should have had my map up today, but it's a little bit darker on the screen, so you might not be able to make it out. But look up a map. Sometimes they're called the Hatti, but the Hittites are in the north. They're in Mesopotamia, if you will, but they're in the north of the land of Canaan. But there's another group. that are known as the Hittites. Look with me at Genesis 15. Genesis 15, and let's look at verse 18. Genesis 15, 18. On that day, Jehovah made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your offspring I will give this land, from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, the land of the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaim, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, and the Jebusites. All those ites. In Hebrew, we represent in English, a word usually is, like Hittite is Hitti. And we just, I don't know why people originally said, well, let's represent that ites, the Girgashites, Jebusites, Amalekites. It's usually, there's usually no ite on the end of any of these, actually. But who are the Hittite? Because we know that Ephron, from whom Abraham buys the plot of land for to bury Sarah, is a Hittite. If you look at verse 20 of chapter 23, let's see, Genesis 23 and verse 10. Now, Ephron was sitting among the Hittites, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the Hittites, of all who went in at the gate of his city. Now, in Hebrew, we have to look at this because in English, you'll notice that I had Hittites, Hittites, Hittites in English. But that's not what we get in Hebrew. I'm going to unpack that for us in a minute. But go with me to Genesis 25, Genesis 25 and verse 9. In 25:9, Isaac and Ishmael, his sons, buried him, this is talking about Abraham, in the cave of Machpelah in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittite, east of Mamre, son of Zohar, the Hittite, Hachiti, Hachiti. In Genesis 49, verses 29 and 30, it mentions this same place. Jacob is going to be buried in that place. And in Genesis 50, another time, it mentions the cave that belonged once to Ephron, Hachiti. All right. But we also have another designation in Hebrew in 23 where the English has Hittite. Sometimes it's Hachiti. But there's another one, and it's B'nai Het. Now, if you can read Hebrew, if you can use online tools, you can see this as you work through. The English sometimes just puts it all, you know, smooths it out for us, the Hittites. But over and over, I'm just going to go through these. I'm going to give you these for your notes. I'm not going to go through each text. But where it says Hittite, there are cases where the people of the land, meaning the people of the land of Canaan, there is a group called the Hittites. We just read it in Genesis 15. These are the sons of Het. So you can write these down or trust that John Baruch Perry will write them down for you, and it'll be considered righteousness on your part. No, I'm joking. B'nai Het, Genesis 23:3. Chapter 23, 5, verse 7, verse 10, verse 16, verse 18, verse 20. All of those will say Hittites in many English translations, but the Hebrew says sons of Het, sons of Het. Chapter 25, 10, chapter 49, verse 32 also have this B'nai Het. So the question is, or I should say the solution is, there is a people dwelling within the land of Canaan, and this is a group known to us as the Hittites. This is not those from Anatolia, from Turkey. Some might suggest that they're a group which broke away from them. All of that is pure speculation. We don't know that. We just simply know that at the time, in this period, in the patriarchal period, we, according to our text, have a group known as the sons of Chet who are living in the land of Canaan. These are Canaanites. Now, we know other Hittites in the Bible that are actually quite interesting. Now, I wanted to bring this point up. We're going to talk more about the Hittites next week. We have to, because Rebecca says, "Don't, if my son, my baby, takes one of these women from the Hittites, I don't know what I'm going to do." All right, so we're going to get into a little bit more about the Hittites. But I want you to think, let's not say that all Hittites are bad Hittites. When is a Hittite a bad Hittite, and when is a Hittite a good Hittite? I'll give you a couple of good ones. Ephron the Hittite, yeah, he got a little markup on his real estate, but a man's got to feed his family. But he doesn't seem like a bad guy. He's a dealer. Now, what about Uriah the Hittite? Does he seem like a bad guy? He seemed like he has been done wrong by David, but he's not a bad guy. In fact, when I read the story of Uriah the Hittite, I think, wow, you know, he's a man of honor, integrity. When David wants to have him killed, remember the whole story? I mean, look, so we have some Hittite, but that's beyond the scope of this class. The point is that the Hittites we're talking about, the sons of Chet, are Canaanites. They're people of the land. Two more verses for you. Go with me to Genesis chapter 10. Genesis 10, verse 15. Canaan fathered Sidon, his firstborn, and Chet, and the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, the Arvadites. You see that? So who is Chet? He's a son of Canaan. So the Hittites, or the Hitti, are Canaanites. They're sons of Canaan. By the way, put this in your notes. 1 Chronicles 1:13 in the genealogical tables will give you another one so that you have two witnesses to the fact that Chet is a son of Canaan. We're going to learn more about that next week. Now, sometime after Sarah dies, Abraham wants a woman for Isaac. He doesn't want her from the daughters of the Canaanites. Remember this, chapter 24, verse 3. But he tells an unnamed servant to go to my land of my nativity. It's Moladti, the place of my birthing, basically. And the servant goes where? To Haran. We already mentioned that in a couple of classes back. He goes to the land where Abraham's from. And there is an oath. There's a story of an oath. And I had to dig into this story for my own knowing. And I'm going to share it with you. Because let me just put it this way. The story tells us that Abraham is old and had come into the days, is the way Tabor translates it. He's old and he's come into the days in chapter 24, verse 1. But this same phrase was used back in 18 where it described Abraham then. He was old and had come to the days. So you get an image in 18 that Abraham is old and decrepit and he's stuck in bed. That's the image a lot of people have. And so you think he's on death's door. He's in bed. He's about to die. The question is this supported by the text? Now, a lot of people, you like this? We're digging a little bit deeper than a lot of people go. I know that. So inquiring minds want to know. That's the image a lot of people have. And we have to jump ahead a little bit to figure out how old is Abraham at this time. Because we know how old he is when he dies. So I want to know, you know, how old is he? Let's see. Abraham, I'm not going to look at that yet. The setting of chapter 24 is when Abram is 140 years old. Okay? Let me see if I should do that or not. You have to understand that in my mind I'm thinking I don't want to give something away for next week, so talk amongst yourself for just a moment. Okay. In chapter 25:20, I can tell you this. Isaac, we learn, was 40 years old when he takes Rebekah as his wife. Right? So we know that Abraham is 100 years old when Isaac is born. So that simple math shows that Abram is 140 years old when he tells his servant, go to my land and get a wife for Isaac. He's 140. But he lives to be 175. Now, do we think then that Abraham is going to be in bed for 35 years? Is he at that point in his life? That question will come back to us. But he makes his servant, this is part of the thing that I had to study for my own, put your hand under my thigh. This troubled me. Because a lot of things that you'll see, you look up in footnotes, or people will often say, well, that's really a euphemism for the male parts. So I should have given a PG-13 warning before I get to this. But it's in the Bible. Is that what that means? All right? Does it have to be that specific? You know, do we say thigh and really mean something else? Because if it's something else, my thought was, I'm glad we don't have that custom. You know, really, I'm not even joking. I'm serious. I think that's just not. And so then I think, well, is it something that is an ancient custom that I should just, maybe I just don't understand it. But it seems strange. Under the thigh. In Hebrew, it's yarek. Now, most footnotes that say this is a euphemism will say that this means such and such or such and such. I know some of you have your children there. You can tell them. But that's not what it means. It's not what it means. You can relax. Okay. By the way, this same phrase, it only occurs twice. Abraham tells his servant to do it, and Jacob in chapter 47, verse 29 says, put your hand under my thigh. So it was common enough that I said, what does this mean? Well, in Genesis chapter 32, verse 26 and 32, when Jacob is wrestling the Malak, or the man that he wrestles with, of course, if you go to Hosea 12, it's another, but if it's it indicates that it's the Malak. And he's touched on the yarek, and he limps. Now, what did he touch? You know, inquiring minds want to know. It's the hip. It's the hip. Look, it's this section here, right? Now, from this section, you can draw, there's a lot more too than just the hip, but it's this area. It means the base. So, for instance, when in the stories of the making of various objects for the tabernacle, like the lampstand, it talks about the yarek. Well, that's talking about the base, the trunk, if you will. So it's like, put your hand under my trunk. Now, by the way, in chapter 5 of Numbers, remember the story about the suspected adulteress? She is told to drink this water, and if you're guilty, her yarek will fall. So it can't mean what some of these footnotes say. You see what I'm saying? I'm just trying to make sure you understand, because what's he putting his hand under? I believe it's put your hand here, under my, right here, the base. Now, that implies a lot of things. And anciently, it could imply the seat or the base from which seed, life comes, okay? By the way, in Song of Songs 3:8 and 7:2, they strap a sword to their yarek. All right? So it's clearly this hip, this trunk, your side. Now, we do have text in Genesis 46, 26, for instance, where it does imply that from this area, this base of a body, the descendants will come. Genesis 46, 26, example. Okay. So here we are. Abraham makes his servant, unnamed servant, swear, go to my place and find a woman for Isaac. Now, I don't think Isaac is there. I think Isaac is at Be'er Lachai Roi, and he is at Beersheba. So he sends his servant, and the servant goes, and this is one of the most beautiful stories. It's the longest narrative story in Genesis, one of the longest, one of two, and it's beautiful because it shows that Abraham's God guides the unnamed servant to the right place and the right time to meet the right woman. And he heads to Aram Naharaim, to the city of Nahor. Now, one of the things that I love, and this is, you know, a lot of times I'll say, that's a good t-shirt idea, but this prayer of the servant, I love this. He says this, Hakrena Lefanai Hayom, Hayom. English, a lot of times is translated, make something happen before me today. He believes that Abraham's God can make something happen. And he has such faith that he says, here's the way we'll do it. The woman that I say, can I have a drink? And she gives me a drink. And then she says, I'll give your camel's drink also. I'll know that's her. And that's what happens. You know the story. Beautiful story. Now, that Rebecca is confirmed is clearly the case as you read through the text. And we get to read the story twice. We get to read the story as it happens, and then we get to read the story as the story is told again. And I think it's worth it. You know, sometimes people say, have you ever watched a movie twice or have you ever read a book twice? That story is good. You know, it's just incredible how all of this was orchestrated by an unseen hand. Now, one thing that I want to point out on this particular story is that by her willingness to go, I'm talking about Rebecca as the story unfolds, will you go? Remember, if she doesn't go, if she says she doesn't want to go, the servant is relieved of the oath that he has made on the hip of Abraham. All right? So he's okay of the, and oaths are far more important back in the day than they are today. But the thing that I like about this is the fact that Rebecca is willing to go sight unseen to a place away from her father's house, away from the land of her birthing, sight unseen to an unknown place. Who does that sound like to you? Abraham. She becomes, in a way, a female version of Abraham in that she's willing to go. She returns with the servant, and on their way, she sees Isaac in the field. Remember, she looks up and she says, who is this? And the servant says, that's my master. And so he's just come back from Be'er Lachai Roi. Now, where is the servant bringing the woman? Well, it must be Hebron, unless they've moved Sarah's tent. Now, this is 3 years later, 3 years after the death of Sarah. How do I know that? Because I know how old Isaac was. He was 40 when this arranged relationship is made. And he was 37 when she died. So 3 years later, and it says that he goes in the tent with her. He loves her. And he's comforted following the death of Sarah. Beautiful story. Then we get to chapter 25. We get to chapter 25, and in verses 1 through 18, we get a glimpse into the family life of Abraham. You might say the other side of the family, for the most part. It talks about Keturah and her sons and lists all the names. Look with me at Genesis 25. I'll just touch on a couple of these points. Genesis 25 and get there. Abraham took another wife. Now I'm reading, let me not read that one. Let's go here. Sorry. Genesis 25 and verse 1. Abraham took another wife. It just says, and again, Abraham, and he took a woman whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimram, Yokshan, Medan, Midian, Ishbak, and Shuah. Yokshan fathered Sheba and Dedan. The sons of Dedan are Ashurim, Letushim, Leumim. The sons of Midian were, and he goes through these lists, okay? You get all the names. Now, Abraham, verse 5, gave all he had to Isaac. But to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts. And while he was still alive, he sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the east country. We're going to further define that later in our story. Some people put it way, way east because they have to make other things fit, but we'll talk about that. So the idea, though, is that Abraham has these other sons, and just like Ishmael and these boys are sent away with parting gifts, but they're sent away. Everything goes to Isaac. Abraham dies and is buried by Isaac and Ishmael. And then we get to the story, beginning in verse 12 of 25, that's a new Eli Toledot. These are the bringings forth of Ishmael. And then it runs through his family. The redactor includes a couple of things here, and I want you to understand what I'm about to say. This section of text is out of place chronologically. How do I know that? Chapter 25 is out of place chronologically, particularly because it gives itself away, and I'll show you, this is what I meant by, sometimes we have an ancient story here and an ancient story here. Both ancient stories are true. The compiler puts a little bit of overlap where the end and the beginning are not quite where they belong. Here's an example. Perhaps this is a fitting conclusion for Eli Toledot Tirach. You want to close your ancient story within the bigger story up. And you say Abraham was born 25, you know, all the way back to the beginning, chapter 11, verse 27 of his work. And he gets to 25 and he says, I've got to wrap this up. Abraham dies. Now, we have to go back in time next week. Why is that? Because Abraham died at 175. Next week, our story picks up 16 years prior to the death of Abraham. He's dead in 25, or his death is mentioned in 25, and that's okay. But I'm just saying he's not dead yet, because our story picks up 16 years prior to the death of Abraham as we continue our new look at the Pentateuch. We're going to go back in time and pick it up, because our focus now shifts to Isaac and Rebekah, for it's in Isaac that your seed will be called. Don't miss, next week, we're beginning a new Eli Toledot. This one is going to be about Isaac, and I hope that you join me. Shabbat Shalom. Shavua Tov. Have a great week.